Want to be a part of the conversation? Then let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. And for the second hour of the show today, I'm very pleased that I'm going to be talking to Stephen from Law of Fiction. Now, Law of Fiction, many of you will know, for a long period of time has been posting, not just posting about what's been going on, but also a number of different lawyers have been involved in challenging some of the measures and the impositions. So commenting on them, but also challenging them legally, judicial reviews, some that together have been involved with in terms of stopping vaccinating children or mandatory impositions, and also in terms of masking and very early on in terms of the school closures. And I'm very pleased to be joined today with Stephen from Law of Fiction. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
I am very good. I wish I was somewhere as sunny as you are.
Well, indeed. So let's take a step back for a minute, right? Three years on, I know in some ways, understandably, many people just want to forget about everything. I do quite often as well, because who doesn't, right? In many ways, it was just a terrible couple of years in many ways. Just tell us how you came about and what the role of Law of Fiction is, just in case some people don't know.
Well, we just had the three-year anniversary when government locked us all down, of course. But there was a slight... did they lock us down or not was a question at the start, particularly around the schools. And what really got my goat in the first place and sort of, you know, got me off my arse and to sort of start the Law of Fiction website was that the government... Well, there's the duplicity of the government. What happened was that there was a challenge taken by Simon Dolan in relation to the closing of the schools. And he complained, one of the challenges was to complain that the government had directed the schools to close. And the defense of the government was, no, we didn't direct them at all. It was just a request. Well, we all watched Nelly, right? I mean, it stinks to high heaven. We all watched to see what we were told. We're pretty much under martial orders, and that applied to the schools as well. And to imagine that there wasn't some communication directly through the educational channels, and the schools didn't know, and head teachers weren't understanding, they had to close their schools straight away, and that there was some sort of choice about it. They could think or go, I'm not so sure. I haven't seen the evidence of this plague yet. We won't close down. It's absolute nonsense. There was a clear direction in practice, and the government said, no, we didn't. It was just a polite request. And that got me. And as a matter of law, the court said, yeah, fair enough. It was a request, not a direction. And I thought, well, are we living in some kind of fiction here? And that's what started Law or Fiction. And then, very good. Right? So that was it. That's why this, you know, it's a, sometimes I think the name is good, other times not so good, but there we are. And that led me through over the next, through all the lockdowns, etc., trying to help people, trying to understand for myself, but trying to help lay people understand what the law was. So with all these guidances not coming out, was it guidance, which they think about, choose not to follow, or was it a legal requirement? And I needed to know, because I couldn't be doing, as a solicitor and officer of the court, I couldn't be out there encouraging people to break the law, and I wouldn't do that. So I needed to understand it, but people need to know. So when they were having a cup of coffee on a bench somewhere, and some police officer or some marshal came along and said, you can't be doing this, you're going to get fined, did they have to get up and move along or not? And no one really knew, but that's what I did. So we got the website going, and I think we did in the end, I'm told, and I'll take the praise. I'm told we did some very useful things with it. So one of the things we helped out was, I think one of the biggest impacts we had was with the face coverings and the masks. And I remember going on with on GB News with Mark Dolan explaining what's a face covering. no one knew, not properly defined. I explained to him, it could, may as well be a cardboard box over your head. That would do it. And it's just this, things like that needs to understand. And also in terms of where were the exemptions for this sort of thing. So I tried to explain, you know, where there might be some grey areas as to exemptions, and really looking at, was someone going to be suffering distress? Was it sufficient distress? Or was it a prospect of harm? Would that be enough to say, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to put on face covering because I'm at risk of harm and I'm going to suffer distress. And according to the NHS websites, at least, they accept that is not required. So it gave, I put out a toolkit effectively to take people through precisely what the law was. So it was there technically if they wanted to look at it, and that would give them the confidence. But then behind all that, they would know, actually, yeah, I can go in. I can, when I walk into that shop, I can say, I'm not going to wear a mask. And they'd have the confidence to do that. And I think that spread quite a lot, and people had the, and at least allowed the conversations, and people did go in, and people did learn to say no. And I think as that practical thing was, I was quite pleased with. And look where we are now. We all know, of course, masks were completely pointless.
So just on, as you're talking, Stephen, I'm having this terrible moment of, like, revisiting all that stuff. And then at the same time, I'm thinking about that charlatan and dangerous individual, but not to say it is just down to him, because it was many people that were involved. But Matt Hancock on the ridiculous reality TV show, which I never watched, but I saw clips of, where he was saying, oh, well, it was just guidance. And to your point about the absolute draconian measures, it was, I never lived through East Germany there. But obviously, I grew up during the Cold War, and that Stasi, like, you can do this and you can't do that, and the control and the regimentation of absolutely everything, and citizens not knowing what they should and shouldn't do, like a kind of Pinter or Beckett play. It was like absolutely insane, a Kafkaesque moment. And yet, as we're now looking back at all of that and seeing these messages, and I mean, it's absolutely infuriating, isn't it? They just were just completely...
Go on. Well, there's 2 points, perhaps. The second point coming in is, which is simply, what did they know? But I'll go back on the first point I mentioned, which is this wasn't just about helping people get into shops, not wear masks, etc. It wasn't just about what can an individual do. But there's the other side of the fence, which is, who is enforcing this? And we have the issue of the politicization of the police, essentially. That's where we get to. And so there was lots of comment by, you know, I was trying to do some practical things, help people who made up their minds, actually, you know, so I don't want to live in this state, and I'm going to exercise my freedoms. There were, I think, the more mainstream, or the majority of lawyers, who mostly said nothing, but where they did say something, they were mostly under the spell of COVID and fear. And there was some excellent technical analysis of these laws and guidance. But the thing which we each had in common, both from my side, which was to do with to continue to exercise our freedom and resist suppression of that, and also from the other lawyers' side, who were fearful and said we should do all we can, and that includes wearing masks or whatever it is, doing antisocial distancing, etc. We were at one in the fact that actually this having this very ill-defined law and the crossover with the guidance was dangerous, because no one really knew where they were. The politicians did or didn't know. You can make your own mind up on that. But the police certainly didn't always know. They were out there going much further than they were allowed. And they were clearly getting instructions, as we've seen from the lockdown files. They were clearly getting instructions, and the government, the ministers were getting heavy with them. I think that was the phrase from the lockdown files and the WhatsApps. And that's what was happening. I mean, that is direct politicization. I think Francis was talking about with you this last week, I'm sure rather more eruditely. But it was the, these are supposed to be people protecting us, not working for the government and enforcing political views. And that's
right, so
what
someone happened. So just on this, I mean, obviously, you're, you know, law fiction, and you're, and so, someone who practices the law, and we do you? I mean, I think we've suffered an enormous blow to the body politic, to the whole sense of the role of the state, the judiciary, what it, you know, elected representatives, how they've played loose and fast. Some people will say, well, actually, it was such a terrifying thing that it's understandable. But what, just firstly, what do you think all of this has meant for people in terms of the views of the law and of the state and of citizens?
Well, I'm not sure how the majority of citizens might view the state of the law as such, but I know where a very significant number of us, significant percentage of the population would view it, which is that the law is, and the courts and the police are simply no longer, well, not there, excuse me, are not there to protect us. We used to think that our government would protect us. Well, scales have fallen from our eyes there. We used to think that the police were there primarily to protect us. I mean, there's always issues, of course, but generally speaking, people still would trust the police. It would still be the question you would tell your children, for most of us at least, would tell your children to respect the uniform and the officers and the police, and they're there to protect you, as a general rule. I mean, obviously, some of us over even the last few decades and perhaps before would be a little bit more nuanced in our advice to children, but nevertheless, generally speaking, on our side, the good guys. Similarly, if there's a problem, if they're not, we could always think we could rely on the courts and go to the courts to look, to stand up for us, stand up for what people now understand to be human rights, is what we call it. But back in the, you know, a long time ago, would have, you know, over centuries, it would have, we might have called it common law. But essentially, we're talking about our rights and our freedoms, and we would have anticipated and expected the courts would be there to protect us. I, and I think a large number of people, simply don't believe that to be the case anymore. The court system is still there. It is still a good system, generally, and there's still an opportunity. I'm not saying throw it away. I'm not suggesting that the judges are bent, by the way. That's not my suggestion. But it's a question of what has happened in practice. And in practice, the COVID mist has descended over the courts. This is my perspective, at least. COVID mist has descended, and they have thrown away and ignored some very basic principles. And the most concerning one, perhaps, is they have simply sided with the government, and they have, in effect, decided to accept that. I mean, most recently, and in litigation which I've been involved with specifically, the courts accept that the mRNA COVID-19 shots are safe and effective. That is effectively the court's position.
So I want to talk to you more about that, but
I'll take it back a bit. But that was also the position in relation from 2020, from March 2020 onwards, in relation to the threat of the virus. So that they essentially said, look, we accept this is a major threat to society, and we follow the government line in it. And that was that. And what happened? And when you're looking at balancing the interference with our freedoms, we do have something. I mean, it would have been common law a long time ago, but in more modern times, the courts have regard to the European Convention on Human Rights. But the difficulty is most of those require some balance. They're not absolute rights. They're qualified rights, which means you look at what's the protection being offered, how much is the interference, and is it justified? You look at justification, and essentially the courts move to the view that everything is justified by COVID. And that's the problem. And so all our protections disappeared because of this fear, which has been swallowed by so many people.
So just before we go to the break, just tell us that, because I want to talk to you about some of the legal challenges you've posed and what they mean and where they're at now and what this all means for us. But you're not saying, are you, like the 120 barristers, that they just won't represent people, they won't represent the government, for instance, around certain people that are being challenged, XR Rebellion or others like that? Or, I mean, what's happening? I mean, in the legal arena, it's quite interesting, isn't it, that they're sort of being political around their own views and not just like implementing, acting accordingly with the law. They're actually taking a political position. Do you see yourself in the same way, or is it different? Just explain the difference, if you would, if there is
one. It's a little bit different. First of all, I'm not a barrister. I'm a solicitor, and I have different rules. I can accept clients through my door or reject them for whatever reason I like, as long as it's not discriminatory, of course. But I can just say no. It's different for the bar. The bar are there to be representing, advocating in front of before the courts. They are supposed to be independent and impartial. That is what they are. That's what they're good at. They should be good at. It's important. It's important that when someone instructs them, that someone introduces them to their barrister, that the client knows that barrister is going to do their best for them, and regardless of their own personal views, they will advocate based on what the law and the facts are, not on their political views as to how the planet's going to change because of whatever they've read in the Sunday Times this morning.
Good.
But it's quite an important point because individually, there's no difficulty. You know, every barrister is entitled to express themselves personally. You know, am I a political beast? Some might say so now. And Francois, you had on last week, he has expressed his very, very clear views. That's fine. Is in his own personal capacity. He does not, to my experience, and is very keen to not let himself be particularly associated with a political cause in the whilst he's being a barrister and representing himself in front of the courts. What they've done here. So, but individual. You might, without too much reading, have a good idea of someone's views. You know what Julian Morn, you know, kind of his stance in the political spectrum. You know Francis Hall's stance, political spectrum, and that might affect you as a client in deciding do you instruct them or not. But what you don't have is a whole group of barristers getting together in this council culture type way. This seems to be coming in from this woke culture to say, this is, you know, if you're supporting anyone who supports fossil fuels, then you must be a bad person. That's really the message they're trying to get across. And if that spreads.
So let me hold you there, Stephen. Let me hold you there because I think that was good. Just to remind everyone, I'm with Stephen Jackson, Law of Fiction. We're going to go to a break and come back and get right on a deep dive on what Law of Fiction has been doing. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll see you in just a moment.
You should hear what James Freeman is talking about on The Freeman Report.
Putin threatens response over Britain's toxic tank shells. Now, the crux of this story is that the UK's Minister of State for Defence, Baroness Goldie, has announced that the Challenger 2 tanks Britain is supplying to Ukraine will be armed with depleted uranium shells. Such rounds are highly effective at defeating modern tanks and armoured vehicles. Well, golly gosh, isn't that dandy? Who would have known that depleted uranium would be good at destroying tanks? Unless, hang on, haven't we used these shells before? Weren't they responsible for significantly increased cancer rates in Iraq? No, surely not. British government would never supply weapons for use in a country that is claiming to help, would it? Wouldn't that be a huge contradiction? Supplying cancerous weapons to be used in the very same lands, yes, the very same lands that are home to the people that it claims to be supporting. No, no, dear boy, you must be mistaken. Well, no, because this is exactly what is happening.
The Freeman Report and James Freeman on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Turn on Alexa and ask her to play
TNT Radio.
Turning on anything else usually requires dinner and conversation, dressing up and brushing your teeth, and I'm already tired.
This is today's news talk
and the voice of freedom,
TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Stephen Jackson from Law or Fiction, and we've just been getting into it. So, Stephen, tell us about some of the more recent legal campaigns you've run and what you're doing at the moment, if you would, please.
Well, we were involved, of course, on the mRNA COVID vaccine mandate, so together for some time. But most recently,
what that was, just before we run off that.
Okay. Go on. Sorry. Well, I'll give you a quick rundown of the case which we've been involved in from the start. Yes. Of this last. But I think the first one, if I recall, was to do with face covering of school children. Lots of difficulties with judicial review of that matter, which we were aware of. But what we looked to do was to go to a particular school, and we had a young child, about 13, if I recall, who was fairly gutsy, actually, but she with her parents were prepared to try and challenge the school and saying, actually, this policy in the school to require all children to wear masks is unlawful. You haven't done any risk assessments for the health impact of these things, I mean, psychologically and physically. And actually, we went to court and we provided a couple of experts' reports, which were really quite shocking. They're still available on Law of Fiction website, and you can on the crowdfunding site, and you can see them. But it was really quite potentially some very unpleasant risks from wearing masks continually. Anyway, went to the court, and the outcome of that was that the defence for the school was successful, but they had to put forward a defence. And this was noted, which is that we do not require the children to wear masks. So they said it's a policy, but if a child says, I'm not going to, then it wasn't enforced. So that was a success in some respects for that case. But that was the mask case. And then I think it was the other matters were to do with these the vaccinations, so-called, of children. I think that's the first one we did. And of course, you remember that this vaccination rollout was brought down in stages. So the vulnerable in adults first, and then to the children, 16, 17, and then 12 through to 15, and then 5 through 11. And we took them in place. And because of the speed of the courts, or rather being slow, they kind of merged into one, more or less. But the issues were much the same, which were to saying there's children simply do not need these experimental treatments. They're at as good as zero risk from COVID. And I think there's been a study in Israel, I just mentioned in passing. I think it was one child in 3.2 million had actually died from COVID. One child of 3.2 million, but the risks we know from these vaccinations, these mRNA shots, is far, far higher than that. So it just made no sense. But nevertheless, anyway, we went to court, and that's the case we took. And the courts, in the end, you know, we put it all there to make sure that the judge could not say it wasn't seen, and we couldn't say the evidence wasn't presented. The evidence was all presented, but the outcome of it all was essentially we got to the point where the court said, we are not going to consider the evidence. The court said, look, this is a pandemic, and this is a decision for the minister as to whether or not, and it's a judgment call to be made, but one for management of the country, effectively management of the health service and our health response to this virus. That's not a judgment call for the courts. It's one for the politicians to make. And it simply said, we're not getting involved. That was the basic go away defense. And as I come back to what I said earlier.
Well, can I just interrupt you there for a second? Can I just interrupt you there for a second? Because on that point, right, it's got to be said, I might on this particular instance have hoped that that hadn't happened, but there is an issue, isn't there? Like if the political elected democratic representatives keep having legal challenges to them. For instance, we saw that with Brexit. So the majority of people voted for something and then there were all these measures in place. And we've seen it subsequently, something like almost tie up, like it might be about border policy, right? It might be about all sorts of things where this idea that you can keep legally tying up elected representatives. So how do you see that, where, you know, that tension and balance between those two things?
I think in the public eye, with immigration, etc., the concern is of tying up the legal system and lawyers making money out of it, etc., and the woke left, etc. That's a perception, and people tend to split along their political views in the old terms, left and right, perhaps. It's not quite the same that we faced here. This was really a question of how the courts viewed their interference with the government. And what they've done, to my mind, is pretty much box themselves into a corner. And we moved to the point where, as it would have been, and we still have, where the courts are willing and where there's a lot of noise, we still have the courts willing to look carefully at government decisions. So judicial review isn't quite dead, but it is there in particular areas, I would suggest. One area it is where it's been closed off, for the moment at least, is in the area where COVID is involved, in response to COVID. And of course, and our concern, I mentioned COVID, our concern is that was then, people say, well, that's been and gone. We're looking at the next pandemic, of course, and then whatever the next excuse is, whatever the next emergency is. And the concern is the courts have put themselves into a corner whereby they will again say, well, we can't get involved here. It's an emergency. We're not looking at it. And that's my real concern on it all. Whether also, and I go back to the point I made earlier, which is that one of the other reasons why the courts refused to engage was they said, look, this is a qualified right. This is, you don't have an absolute right to, effectively, you don't have an absolute right not to be coerced. If we move on to the mandates with the nurses, with the health workers. What the courts never did, to my recollection, although we used the word coercion, we complained about coercion, to my recollection, not in one judgment or in one utterance from behind the bench was there use of the word coercion. It seemed to me it was being avoided if it was something dirty. And yes, it was something dirty. It still is something really, really dirty. But that's why I think the word was never used. What the courts said was that they said this was never a mandate. So although you lose your job, you lose your income, you lose access to going down the pub or to a restaurant or to theatre, although you lose all those things, that's not a mandate. It's not pinning you down on the floor to inject you, which of course would be quite outrageous. They couldn't do that. But the government isn't doing that. And they said, but everything else was balanced and within a not perverse and something which the government was entitled to do. That's where you've ended up with the courts effectively moving towards and siding with the government. And again, it's a simple question of adopting the fear narrative and accepting what's being said at face value without allowing any scrutiny of it.
But can I ask you, just so people understand and realize, because you when you started this, you did it to clarify the difference between rules and guidance and law, and give people an opportunity, citizens, to make decisions based on what the reality was and everything. At the end of the day, I've made this point. I had conversations with you before. I think that and that together, and we all work together, and people that we've done campaigns and like we on the mandate. Whilst legal challenges are okay and they're fine and they're good, in the end, the way we really change things is to have the public assert itself and to say we're not going to have that. Right? That surely is the way, because it isn't the danger that if one always tries to do it legally, I'm not saying you're saying that we should always do it legally, but it, in the context, you get so many of these knockbacks based on legal precedents or terminology. And actually, there's a political, there's a moral, there's an ethical dimension to all of this. And that's why when some people say we've got to take them to court, we've got, this is illegal, actually, is it immoral? And what politically are we going to do about it?
You're absolutely right. And what I was going to move on to say, and you take me there, which is that we've been where we have been, judicial review. I said it's dead for the moment, more or less, as far as COVID is concerned. For the moment. But the point is, it's a question of moving the public opinion. And I am completely on side with many who have the view, you've got to change the court of public opinion first. We've had centuries of peace in this country, because largely, I think, or at least a large part to do with it, is we've had a stable and flexible court system. The courts can move with the times. They have moved with the times. They moved too blooming quickly on this occasion, was my view, but far too far. But they can come back. They are the judiciary and everyone within the court system. They're members of the public as well. They see what they read, the press, they read what's on the internet, etc., and they can fall for it, or they can read away from it and educate themselves, but then the public can move. So yes, educate the public, and then we can go back with the courts again. It was important to do these court cases, and there are still cases which need to be run. If only to put some pressure on, it does create pressure, and it also keeps a record, and we take it as far as we can. Some of these we haven't appealed because we could have got ourselves further into a deeper hole. But there's a record that it's raising awareness and important. But yes, when the public moves, that's what we do. And so that's why the Together campaigns are so important. And I think and the lawyers get behind it, but it's got to be run by the public in the first place. Absolutely right.
So just before we finish and we go to the break, just tell us what your latest, your current campaign is, and then we can leave off on that. Thank you, Stephen.
I'm currently doing something where I'm working for Tom's mother. Tom, not Tom's real name, but Tom is a 22, I think now 23 year old, but he's intellectually disabled. He's got the mental age of 18 months, thereabouts. He has trisomy 13, which is a rare chromosomal condition, that caused him to have these mental issues, but physically quite well. But he had a heart problem when he was born. What's happened there is, of course, the mother, the local authority, like many others, are insisting that Tom is injected with this mRNA experimental therapy. And the mother would rather it doesn't happen. No one has said, the court has not said, the local authority have not suggested that her view is unreasonable or crazy or perverse. It is accepted as being reasonable. And yet, what's happened effectively, and there's no one else objecting on the side. So this is the local authority saying to Tom's mother, we want your son to be to have this COVID vaccine. And they've taken it to court, and the court have sided with the authority. And they've done so effectively by taking judicial notice, in the same way as you might take judicial notice that the earth is round and not flat. That's non-controversial. Everyone accepts that these days, and we can see it by curvature of the horizon, etc. We know about these things. We've even seen pictures from space. So that is, in the same way we take judicial notice that the earth is round, effectively, but they're not saying it, the court is taking judicial notice that the COVID-19 vaccines are safe and effective. And in respect of this particular individual, of course, none of us are required or even been sent, many of us not even being sent any reminders to have boosters and the like these days. But the vulnerable, and Tom is being classified as vulnerable because of his mental age, effectively. Because of that, he's on the list where the government recommends the COVID-19 vaccination for him. So there's a recommendation from government against the decision of the mother, which wins. And the court have said, we follow the government recommendation. So the court is siding with the government. So that's what the case is about, and what's happening, therefore, and it could happen to any of us, because Tom doesn't have the mental capacity to make his own decisions. The court has decided that Tom, because he's reached 18, so just go back a bit, prior to 18, they would accept the mother makes the decision, the family makes the decision. Yeah. 18th birthday comes along, bang, all of a sudden the family loses its responsibility for the medical treatment and care of their children, because they are, in the eyes of the law, no longer children, they are adults. And then the court moves on to say that because Tom is an adult, he should not suffer disability discrimination. He is entitled to autonomy, decision-making autonomy in respect of his health, like any other person, any other fully able-bodied and mentally able person. And so it must be important he's not disadvantaged. So how does that happen? The court says, therefore, the Medical Capacity Act, the court says, passes that decision-making power to the local authorities and ultimately to the court. So right.
Just in a nutshell, Stephen, just finish us up. Just tell people how they can find you and see you, because we're going to go to a break and finish up now. But it's at Law or Fiction. Yeah. Where's the website? And if people want to see you and do a bit more, where can they find you?
If they go on Twitter at Law or Fiction, and they'll find Tom's case in a pinned tweet. If they go on to crowdjustice.com, that's crowdjustice.com, and search for Tom, then the case will come up. And
great.
That's it. We're good to break.
Thank you. We're running out of time. Sorry, Stephen. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your continued efforts, both in the legal arena and in championing things politically. You'll be hearing more from Stephen, because hopefully he'll be helping us with the Together Cabinet, with the law and policing section, which we're going to be launching very soon, the Shadow Together Cabinet that's going to be coming out pumping, fighting, full of ideas, lots of great speakers. More on that soon. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. I'm going to be back with you solo after this.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
What happens to a person who tweets out that homosexuality is invading the church? Well, if your 37-year-old Christian theology lecturer, Dr. Aaron Edwards at the Methodist-run Cliff College in England, you get fired. According to the Christian Post, Edwards, who has worked there for 7 years, told the Telegraph he was also threatened with a counter-terrorism referral by the school. Here's what he tweeted. Homosexuality is invading the church. Evangelicals no longer see the severity of this because they're busy apologizing for their apparently barbaric homophobia, whether or not it's true. This is a gospel issue, he said. And for that, the father of five got the boot for what the school called misconduct, which had brought the institution into disrepute. He argued that maintaining an evangelical stance was crucial for the institution's student base and heritage. Dr. Edwards is currently considering legal action and appealing his termination with support from Christian Concern. He also set up a crowdfunder where he's asking people to contribute if they wish. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
A social credit system was introduced in China in 2014. China's social credit system is a nationwide government program for regulation of citizens' behavior based on a point system. Under this system, citizens are assessed using data collected from court documents, government or corporate records, and even from neighbors and observers. Citizens with higher scores are eligible for bank loans, free medical checkups, and other services in demand. Points are deducted for traffic violations, defaulting on loan payments, smoking in non-smoking zones, buying or playing too many video games, posting false news stories online, and other transgressions deemed appropriate by authorities. Citizens with bad social credit scores can be denied essential services, and blacklists are available for employers, educational institutions, and credit providers to reference. When introduced by China's State Council, it was announced the system would favor the trustworthy to roam everywhere under heaven, while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. In the last part of the show, 3 years on from lockdown, just to take a bit of an overview of where we're at. Well, we see the cost of lockdown, cost of living crisis continuing. We see the sluggishness, not just of having shut down the economy and having far more waiting for our health services at the NHS and elsewhere, but in terms of losing tens of thousands of retail and hospitality businesses, in terms of the damages to the economy, in terms of the lack of the workforce going back into the workforce, many more working from home, many more claiming health issues and not even engaging. We've seen the impacts to education and schooling and children and young people. We've seen the harms and damages to families. And we've also seen a situation where many technocrats think it's okay and acceptable to impose measures without full scrutiny, without cost-benefit analysis, without engaging transparently and openly with the electorate, with the public. Interestingly, though, of course, we see some inspiring things like the Dutch farmers in a similar vein to how the Canadian truckers stood up, and the Dutch farmers have been challenging things. The second biggest agricultural producer in the Netherlands, and they've been challenging some of the measures that are imposed by the government and what's going on with the EU. And we've seen that what that has meant has actually been not just on the streets and driving in their tractors to the capital, but also the citizens are very supportive and winning a significant section of the electorate. Most recently with the BBB, the Farmers Citizens Party. We'll see what that all means. But we know in Britain, we've got local elections in various parts of the country, local elections where many independents are standing. We saw that in Oxford, Michael Evans stood in Littlemore and narrowly missed winning that against LTNs on low traffic neighbourhoods just on that basis. And we see that people are standing on freedom issues up and down the country. Many, many more people are politically homeless. Two-thirds of people actually say they are. Hardly surprising when our elected representatives seem to be so remote, so distant from our everyday concerns and needs and realities, why the public seems to be last on the list when policy measures are implemented, when we have leaders like Sadiq Khan saying that he's going to ignore 5,000 respondents to a so-called consultation because he doesn't like the fact that they're linked to Fair Fuel. And then he's going to ignore the other 65% who say they don't want it because, oh, well, after all, it's not a referendum and it's not about a democratic consideration. Notwithstanding, he's already bought the ANPR cameras in advance of the consultation, and to boot, he is citing numbers to legitimize this measure that are entirely incorrect. In fact, Mayor Sadiq Khan has been citing this 4,000 people dying per year when it was absolutely said By the two sets of groups that have been involved in the reports, the UK HSA, those who will know that, the UK Health and Security Agency, and the Committee on Medical Effects of Air Pollutants, COMAP, they've said they should not find any evidence of a causal link between air pollution and mortality. But Sadiq Khan, despite this, has decided, along with TfL, along with Transport for London, that's his last position. That's his last reason for doing this. Well, 4,000, we need to save those lives. No, unacceptable. You're using dodgy, faked up, effectively. You've done it on purpose, disingenuously, misinforming people, misinforming the public, doing this disingenuously, dishonestly. Let's just call it what it is. And we see this as in the same way that we see that Oxfordshire County Council suppressed reports that challenged and contradicted what they wanted to be seen in the public arena whilst the so-called consultation was out and did not come out until afterwards. You see these measures, and when we see them being done to us as the public, you gasp at first, and then some people have just become like accepting of it, cynical. Oh, this is just what they're like. It's unacceptable, though. And at the togetherdeclaration.org, we think that the public should be at the heart of things. We should think our voices, our concerns, our requirements of what our streets, our neighbourhoods, our cities and our country should be like is paramount. Not what the markets, not what anyone at Davos says, and not, you know, what technocrats think need to happen to us. Not because of the latest emergency or the state of crisis. So you must do this and you get nudged and corralled or pushed into that. But because of what we need of productivity, of the need to develop, of wealth creation for everyone, that our interests, our needs should be put at the heart of it. And that's why at Together, we're launching our Together Cabinet, which has a number of different areas where we will be increasingly lobbying and campaigning and pressurizing around and releasing reports like we've done with Ben Pyle recently on the ULEZ extension, which people can see at togetherdeclaration.org. And you can see Ben Pyle at Climb 8 Resistance. He's been on the show. He's on the first ever show I did here, actually. That's Climb 8 Resistance, Ben Pyle, who also has climatedebate.co.uk. That's who we did the report with at Together Declaration that actually shows that what has been done by Sadiq Khan is very, very wrong. And on the 15th of April, we can announce this publicly. We, along with Action on ULEZ, are challenging further. We've got a rally that's going to be in Trafalgar Square, and we're inviting everyone to come along that wants to challenge ULEZ. Obviously, we know that many local leaders, local councils and local authorities are saying they do not want this to happen with the ULEZ expansion. They do not want it. They will not support putting up the cameras. Sadiq Khan says, well, it doesn't matter. I'm going to get TfL to implement it anyway because I've bought the cameras. Complete contempt for the majority of the public, of residents, businesses, drivers, across the board. So we've seen council leaders and MPs, Labour MPs and others have challenged him, saying this will have a detrimental impact on working people, on the least well-off. It seems he does not care. In the same way that Philip Glanville does not care what so many people think in Hackney, but he's saying he wants three quarters of the roads closed. Mike Hakata in Haringey saying this is going to be painful, but this is what needs to have happen. Well, together we're working with people across London, across regions and across the UK, whether it's in Cambridge and Bath, where they've got a ring of steel and low traffic neighbourhoods, or whether it's in Canterbury and Oxford. And we're working with local campaigners, local residents and businesses who are fed up of having to see businesses close and have their revenues reduced and customers cut back because of these roadblocks, because of these so-called 15 and 20 minute neighborhoods that people have said they do not want. There's been no cost benefit analysis. There's these impositions and measures that are put on there. And we're having a national fight back, a national challenge that's saying no more of this. Obviously, as I said, some people are standing in the local elections. The good statistician at Twitter, Nigel Jacklin's involved in the Democratic Network, and that you can there are candidates that are being done by that, as well as the independent network with Marianne Overton and others. You can still stand till the 4th of April. You can get your submission in and you can argue for the case for freedom if you choose. It's not the only thing, of course, because we encourage all sorts of campaigning. We're continuing with our challenges to ULEZ expansion, to 15 and 20 minute neighbourhoods and to low traffic neighbourhoods, where we write to councillors, we phone them and we call them, we write to MPs, we phone them, we call them, we post and we go to the surgeries and we say that we won't be voting for them in the upcoming elections and we'll vote for someone who stands on a basis of freedom and choice and autonomy. And some people, of course, have wanted to just throw names at people. They wanted to smear people. They wanted to call them, conspiracists or far this, far right or whatever it might be. But it seems to me that what's lacking is a proper open debate, a discussion where you can say, well, these are the things we disagree with. This is the virtue of our argument. This is what you're saying. It's really clear to most people, actually, who are looking at this, whilst a few want to throw these smears out, obviously, you can start calling people Nazis and far right. For those of us who have families who might have lived through all of that, we know it's nothing like that. And it's really an insult to all of that to do it. Or when Sadiq Khan starts calling deniers and making that link to Holocaust deniers. But in actual fact, the councillors, the elected representatives that we've all invited to come to speak to residents and businesses in Oxford, those that we've invited to speak in Bath and in other areas, have not done that. Now, some did in Cambridge and some came out and spoke. And indeed, one did in Oxford, is in the opponents. But generally, those that are in power, that are implementing these measures, have not been prepared to do it. So you've got some who are calling names and others who are not willing to engage. And in many ways, if you're upset or concerned about the democratic deficit, what I was talking to Toby at the first hour of the show about what's happened to democracy, not just in the last 3 years, but certainly that was put on steroids, on this notion that the people that run things can just impose things on us, can just nudge and prod and implement and, when in doubt, regulate. We've got these new legislation coming down the line around a range of areas, whether it's to do with how we protest, speech, and really, we're the last line of defense. It was interesting that Eva Vlaardingerbroek, I can never pronounce her name, but many of you will know, in terms of the Dutch farmers, has been working with them, supporting them, and that they have the support of the citizens. And I think that the hearts and minds position now in Britain is essential to go out and win arguments around our freedoms, about privacy, autonomy, and choice. We're seeing the discussion not just about the Dutch farmers, not just what's happening in France. And, you know, you could have a big discussion about whether the pension age of retirement should be increased or not. But, you know, in the last few years, we've seen the treatment of French citizens by Macron. We saw that with the Gilets Jaunes. We saw that during lockdowns, as we saw some of those things in Italy. But whatever the situation is, that we have a hearts and minds discussion. We appeal to our fellow citizens to get involved, because in many ways, we're facing some of the biggest challenges now, many as a consequence of some of the lockdowns and harms, but also as the consequence of the response to 2008, quantitative easing, lots of cash pumped into the economy, a lack of productivity, and now banks teetering, the discussion and the implementation of digital ID, and of course, central bank digital currency, where, you know, we're told to not be concerned about Deutsche Bank today in Germany, as it says in the FT. But we know that when people tell us not to be concerned about some of these things, it can be very concerning. That's not to be overly dramatic, but just to say that as we head down this direction, the idea that some want to survey, want to mandatory ID, want to charge and prod and nudge and push and shut off and ticket us, that's not what we've signed up for. We never agreed to sign over our mobility. The idea of us being rational agents that can be free, that are free, and can make decisions over where we drive, who we visit, how we do that, without the encumbrance of officials and others telling us that this is for our own good, that they're stopping us doing this, that they're only allowing a certain amount of permits per year. It's for your own good. It's to keep you safe. It's to keep us all healthy. It's to keep us all alive. Well, frankly, we need to ensure that our fundamental rights and freedom and privacy are retained. And if you believe that and you agree with that, you should get involved with togetherdeclaration.org. And we are going to be doing a big rally in Trafalgar Square on the 15th of April. That's our next event, although we have smaller events around the country. You can get involved with local and regional hubs. And we'd love to see as many people as possible. We're going to be announcing speakers as we go for that. That's on the 15th of April, Trafalgar Square, starting at midday. Many people have been out there recently over the weeks on a Saturday at midday challenging things. I was there just last week, actually. Really good turnout. So, around the country, keep having your voices heard. We are the many, they are few. If you're not happy with technocrats imposing things, you should get involved with togetherdeclaration.org. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. Thank you so much for our guests today. And I'll see you next week with some very exciting guests. Let's stay free, keep fighting for it, insist upon it. We're stronger and better together.